Hi, this is Luke.
And this is Tobin from Quest Research.
Hey, Tobin, what do you get when four guys with absolutely no video experience whatsoever decide to produce their own online paranormal TV show?
I don't know. What? Oh, wait. I do know. Ghost Diaries, right?
That's right.
You can check us out and get involved at www.questresearch.net. And the good thing about being new is that we will only get better.
Listen to Darker Side of the Moon Thursday nights at 9 p.m. Eastern Time.
Visit our website at darkersideradio.com.
From horror movies to the paranormal, we cover it all.
It's a spooky, weird, and zany kind of show.
With your hosts,
Laura Moon
and Becky Ray.
Don't miss it.
Cinema. We're hanging out at the Haunted Winery here in Warren, Michigan with the good folks from Ghostly Talk. Ooh, this place is creepy, man, but nowhere near as creepy as Wolfman Max Nightmare Cinema. It's a haunted drive-in, babies, and you know what we do there? We host classic B-horror and sci-fi movies, just like the ones you grew up with when you was a kid. But it's at Wolfman Max Nightmare Cinema right now, hosting on public access TV all over Metro Detroit. Guess what, kiddies? It's coming to you, and all you gotta do is have a computer. Just go to Wolfman Max Nightmare Cinema. It's nightmarecinema.com. We'll be broadcasting the show real soon, right from the website. Stay tuned. It's Wolfman Max Nightmare Cinema. Bye!
Interested in ghosts? UFOs? How about the occult? Are you psychic? Would you like to find out? Well, if you're intrigued by the world's curiosities and all that is paranormal, then Paralore.com is a place for you. Create your own profile, start a photo album, write a blog, or just hang out and watch countless hours worth of paranormal videos while chatting with other Paralore members. Who knows? You could win a prize or two if you're quick and brave enough. It's all here, and it's all free. Visit www.paralore.com and join today. Again, membership is free, and we know you won't be disappointed.
Paralore.com. Unlock your mind.
Right.
That was hot.
Yeah, it kind of mystified me, too, there.
A killer riff right there, man.
It was awesome.
All right. Hey,
here's what's up next. Are you ready?
Yeah, I'm ready.
Scott Elson. All
right.
Awesome. Ted Phillips is the director of the Center for UFO Research. He's an engineer. Was that a pretty sudden stop there?
Broke there. I don't know what happened.
Ted Phillips is the director of the Center for UFO Research. He is an engineer, professional photographer, and professional musician.
Mm-hmm.
He was a participant in the Vanguard Satellite Tracking Program and a field engineer on the Minuteman Missile Project. He began investigating UFO reports in 1964. He was a research associate of Dr. J. Allen Hynek from 1968 until Dr. Hynek's death in 1986.
Mm-hmm.
It was at Allen Hynek's suggestion that he began specializing in physical traces with UFO sightings in 1968. Phillips has personally investigated hundreds of UFO cases, and his files contain 3,189 physical trace landings from 91 countries. The website is UFOphysical.com, and I'm going to spell that UFOphysical.com. And Ghostly Talk would like to welcome Ted Phillips to the show. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you.
First of all, I need to thank you most of all, Ted, for coming on at such short notice. I think we locked this one down like literally in the afternoon on Friday, if I'm correct.
Yeah, that's right.
And you were a real trooper, so thank you. And I mean, going through the material, I'm really excited to talk to you about this stuff. First of all, I have to admire your conciseness on how many cases are case file. Because, I mean, there isn't like, around, over 3,000. I mean, you're like 3,189 physical trace landings, which is a very exact number. It's rare you see that. I mean, I don't know when that was written. Has that grown since then?
Yes, as a matter of fact, it's grown a bit. 3,387 cases from 92 countries now.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Those are cases that I have on file, and over all these years, I've investigated a fair part of those. And so when the folks say, the skeptics like to say, where's the evidence? How about 3,387 cases? And because all of these involve the observation of an object, many of them in daylight,
mm-hmm.
With the object either sitting on the ground or within 5-10 feet of the ground, and the witnesses not only seeing the object, but the generating of the physical evidence that it leaves behind. And so this is not, were these caused by a UFO? Yes, indeed.
Well, here's the thing, and we're talking about trace evidence. I think that's what we're focused on here.
This is
fascinating.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
And it's because, Ted, this is different, I think, because it's not just I was driving down the road, and now these are compelling enough,
right? Yeah.
They're compelling enough. You know, I was driving down the road, light, you know, comes, car dies, or car, you know, acts funny, you know, light shines there. It's like they observed me, and then whoosh, it took off at an impossible speed.
Yeah.
No, it wasn't Jupiter. It wasn't a planet. You know, I mean, that's the normal. Not the normal.
That's what you hear a lot,
that's
though.
Normal, but that's like a cut and dry thing. Mm-hmm. This is a research into a very specific, a rather specific kind of UFO. Encounter that, you know, touches the earth
it's evidence left over, which is much like, you know, any type of police investigator out there. I mean, that's what they're looking
for.
It's
like CSI. It's CSI for UFOs.
Yeah.
And Ted, that excites me.
What do you guys... I mean, we mean that. I mean, I don't mean... It's funny. I know. I really mean that, though. I mean, it's an interesting...
No, I like excited people. That's good. Well, and you're spot on, because basically, long before any of us were watching CSI and such shows, you know, that's exactly what I was doing. And each of these sites in the good cases, the high strangeness things, I treat the residue that's left behind or the effects that are found on the ground, trees, whatever, as sort of a crime scene, and you're looking for any minute trace of anything out of the ordinary, and it's been pretty astonishing, some of the things that I've walked into, and of course the exciting thing is that all this is still going on, and I might mention that the first physical trace case that I have manuscripts on file from took place in 1490. And obviously I wasn't able to investigate those traces, but I came along about 2 years later.
Sounds like you and me are in the running.
But it's you know, it's very cool when you find a documented case from, we'll say, 1920, where a guy is sitting fishing alongside a pond in daylight, nice conditions and so on, and a 4-foot metallic object lands about 30 feet from him and sits there for 15 minutes, and it takes off silently, and it leaves behind a nice 4-foot oval dehydrated area in the soil and grass. And then we come on up to the current time and we see precisely the same things.
Well, I tell you, Ted, if I would have saw something like that land while I was fishing, I would not have taken off quietly at all. I would have been very loud running away.
yeah, I know. It surprises me, really, that in many of the very good cases, witnesses remain pretty calm, and especially, you know, if there's more than one person, it's a little less scary, and if it's in daylight, it's less scary yet, and they, you know, they're sort of awestruck by what they're looking at, because they've not seen anything like it before, and so they take in a lot of details, and the wonderful thing about these types of cases is that the object, again, is on or very near the ground, and they have reference points in front of, in other words, between they and the object, and behind it and around it, and they see the effects being generated, in many cases, right before their eyes, and so they can go to the exact spot. And so it's not like someone saying, well, I found this ring, but I didn't see an object, and I'm assuming this was caused by a UFO. Well, none of the cases that I have on file involve unusual sights on the ground unless an object was seen there at that point, because we want to establish that this is a result of an unknown object having been in the neighborhood and actually had generated these effects. And so it's, I think, some of the very best proof, if not the best proof, that these things are material objects, that they have mass, and in a number of the cases, the objects land on three or four landing legs, at the base of which there are landing pads of definite configurations, and these pad marks are found in the ground. Well, we can then run compression tests on the soil within those pad areas and formulate the approximate weight of the object. And many of the objects that I've investigated, indicated by these landing sites, weighed on the order of anywhere from 7 to 14 tons.
God!
Yeah, so this is not a ghost or a goblin. It's not a hallucination. Or the planet Venus. And so, you know, we eliminate a lot of possibilities when we take it out of the air at a distance and place it within 15 feet of multiple witnesses in daylight.
It would be also difficult to hoax this kind of thing, because because I do know people who want, I don't know them personally, but I do know of people who, you know, claim that other people hoax things. We've got the Bigfoot sightings. Every field in the paranormal has, obviously, the hoax is a thread throughout everything, and you always have to be on the lookout for it.
Yeah.
Well,
absolutely.
For me to even try and think of how to compress soil enough to make it
seem to give
like
a reading that would be 7 to 14 tons, yeah,
tons was sitting on top of that soil, I wouldn't even know where, because you can't just jump up and down on the soil.
Unless you go out and buy an Escalade or something like that.
Well, yeah, an Escalade.
I'm a funny guy.
But no, it would be difficult.
In these landing pad areas, I would point out the soil has not been scooped or dug out. Mm-hmm. It has been compressed downward. And you can look at these sites much in the same way if you had a Russian secret aircraft land in a field in the middle of Kansas. And what do? You go in, you look at tire marks, you get from those tire marks, those indentations, the weight of the aircraft, and you look for fuel residue, for any sort of trace that would indicate the propulsion system involved, and you can retro-analyze and sort of reconstruct what it was that had been there. So I think this is, you know, an extremely important part of the UFO puzzle.
Oh, yeah.
And so lights in the sky are interesting, but distant lights in the night sky can be a lot of things. And so Alan Hynek suggested to me in 1968 that the sure way to try to develop information, data, solid data on UFOs would be to go after the cases involving physical evidence.
Yeah.
And so I set out to do that. And Alan was a tremendously forward thinker. And here we wind up with 3,387 cases now. And I would point out that 20% of those cases do involve little critters, little guys. Generally under the objects, not getting great distances from the objects, but again, seen in daylight by very credible witnesses, and small footprints indicating, again, by compression, a weight on the part of the little guy of about 60 pounds, which correlates with the things being 3 feet tall, and so on.
And that's we've heard that a lot. We've heard a lot. I mean, as far as the size of some of these beings that some people have seen,
yeah, that really,
they were substantially shorter than the average adult human being.
And what's,
absolutely,
what's fascinating is this stuff is, it's like, you know how the human brain plays, it plays tricks, or
yeah,
it can, it can interpret what you see and then what you recant, or not recount. What you recount later may, while yes to you it's the absolute positive truth, but it was you know, you may not have been able to find the words, or you may be describing it just ever so slightly,
yeah, yeah.
Or if you, you know, if you describe a person to a police sketch artist, and then the sketch is you know, it's close, but it's not exact to the, you know, the guy, because
yeah.
it's just a sketch,
just
an artist's rendition
yeah.
of your description. So you get this, you know, you've got a communication barrier, you've got a memory barrier, you've got a couple things that you're going through. But what you're analyzing are, like, there is this footprint right here, and the tests show it was a 90-pound or a 60-pound being. Mm. And I mean, this is on...
Well, this is stuff that's based in hard science here we're talking
it's
about.
It's amazing.
Yes.
And wants.
Yes.
Have you found any propulsion residues on any of these? Like, what...
Yeah, you mentioned that.
Has there been... Cause, yeah, I keyed into that right away, because I'm interested
well,
in what makes these things go or stop.
Right. Well, therein is a problem. Now, while the physical evidence is some of the very best stuff we can get, the problem then is to get the proper analysis of those materials done. And even Alan Hynek, who was a highly respected scientist,
oh yeah,
we could rarely get the kind of analysis done in the proper laboratories to go down to the nth degree and figure out where we could say, okay, this did this, this is the cause of this.
Mm-hmm.
And that still is a major problem even today, because I've had cases where I would send samples from really extraordinary sites to major laboratories. And in one case out in Kansas, I sent quite a number of soil samples to Oak Ridge. And Oak Ridge certainly has the stuff to do the proper analysis. And at that time, there was a project going on there called Project Orion. And the director of that project was a good friend of Alan's.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was really pushing this along. And they were starting to get, some extremely interesting results in that the soil from this site had been totally dehydrated, sapped of all moisture, and the dirt had been sealed off by some sort of coating. And they reached the point where they were sending us electron microscopic images showing just this coating, and inside the coating they were finding little structures that they call icicles, and no one at Oak Ridge could identify these. They'd never seen anything like it before, and so we're moving along here, and suddenly one day Al and I get letters from his good friend, the director of the project, saying, due to a change in management, we can no longer work with this material. And which I think was kind of a nice way of saying, well, we have some very large government contracts,
mm-hmm.
and why should we tell you? And so that's where it becomes frustrating.
We've heard this time and time again, Ted. I mean, a lot of people that are out there doing this work, they've been hit by these roadblocks left
yes.
and right trying to get to something, and then somebody will step in ultimately and say, nope, and they'll cut the valve off to them like this. You know,
that's absolutely right.
And, I don't want to try to slant this to a conspiracy conversation, but I mean, it's definitely part of the whole UFO phenomena, I think.
Mm-hmm.
There's been stuff, you know, one thing I wanted to mention, we got a couple minutes before we go to break here. You're talking about trace evidence, and, you know, you can't have a conversation on UFOs unless you talk about Roswell. I'm sure you know that, Ted.
Oh, yes.
Well, and I'm sorry if I bore you, I apologize in advance. But, I mean, you may be able to shed some light on this. I've read stuff, we've all seen all types of wild stuff, you know, stuff on the History Channel. I've read countless articles on the Internet. I've read a couple books on the subject, and that is Roswell, like I mentioned. One of the things that they said left, and God knows where it is now, by the way, too, but they said they did find, you know, this UFO crashed, they said. This thing crashed out there, and there was parts all over the place. And one of the things that they found that was left over was, you know, a part of the ship. It was a piece of metallic-like, it was a metallic-like substance that they could not neither bend nor break nor cut nor anything. It was indestructible. And this was just, you know, from people that were, you know, that were part of the incident, right? And what they referred, what they called it was Roswellium. That's what they named that.
You mean
right?
That rod or something indentations
that,
in it?
Yeah,
like
that
writing?
Was probably part of it. Yeah. Have you heard about this, Ted?
Oh, yes. Yeah. A good friend of mine, Stanton Friedman, has done a lot of research into the Roswell thing.
We love Stanton. And, he's a great guy.
Oh, yeah. Stanton is good.
Oh, yeah. Oh, is he?
He's a great friend, and he does tremendous work. Mm-hmm. And the problem with Roswell, I don't rank that even in the top 100 trace cases.
Right.
No, I don't. And the reason is you can't really lay your hands on any of this alleged evidence.
Mm-hmm.
And to be fair, I did on an airliner coming back from Florida one day have a fellow researcher drop a piece of metallic material into my hand. He was holding it maybe 6-8 inches above my hand, dropped it, and you couldn't feel it hit your hand. It was that light.
Wow.
And he would crumple the stuff up into a ball, drop it into your hand, and it would just level itself right out. And this was back in the early 70s,
mm-hmm.
and he was taking this material to Washington, D.C. for analysis. Well, mistake number one, after it went to Washington, D.C., it was never seen or heard of again.
Oh,
so
man,
there
man.
You are. But this was not from Roswell. This was from a foreign country, another supposed crash site.
Mm-hmm.
And but Roswell, it just, I mean, there are so many cases that are so much better as far as documentation and the traces.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, because they were there, we were able to sample them.
Mm-hmm.
And get them analyzed as best we could. Roswell, I wish someone had a piece of that stuff in their attic, which they may have, and dropped that into someone's hand where it could be looked at, and then Roswell, in my mind, would be a whole new ballgame.
Well, that's again. I mean, we've heard all the stories out there about this thing, and we've also heard the stories of, well, there's nothing left. Can't find anything that was left over. Where did it all go? Question. Right.
Right. Underground vaults, et cetera.
Yeah. Who knows? I tell you what, Ted. We're gonna go take a quick break here. What I'd like to do after the break, if you want, is talk about maybe some of these more credible cases, if you're cool with that.
Sure.
As far as some of the trace evidence you're talking about, because this is just blowing me away right now. This is really interesting stuff.
This is fascinating.
Because we talk about ghosts all the time, and that's all. I mean, we love talking about ghosts, but it's, you know.
Hey, ghosts are good.
Ghosts are great. I mean, I love ghosts. Ghosts are fun. I mean, that's our bread and butter here. But it's like,
but
we're talking about trace evidence here. Yeah,
this is science.
This
is amazing stuff.
All right,
I love it.
Let's take a quick break here. This is Ghostly Talk. I am Scott Adams.
And I'm Doug.
We'll be back here with Ted Phillips in a few minutes.
Would you like to listen to Ghostly Talk live on your cell phone? Perhaps you have a comment for us or our guests. All you have to do is dial 605-45-8590. When asked for the conference code, dial 555-1081, followed by the pound sign.
I'm Tim Yancey, inviting you to explore the fascinating realm of the paranormal. Ghosts and hauntings, Bigfoot, UFOs, and alien abductions. Join me live every Sunday evening at 9 p.m. with the foremost authorities and experts in the world regarding the mysterious realm of the unexplained. The Encounters Paranormal Radio Series, as heard on WBZT 1230 AM. EncountersBroadcasting.com.
To go bump in the night. Night Watchers at nightwatchers.info. Whether you're an amateur or a professional paranormal investigator, the Night Watchers want you to investigate some of the country's most haunted places. The Night Watchers want you. Already in a group? Perfect. Groups are welcome. Join today at nightwatchers.info. Night Watchers at nightwatchers.info. The future of paranormal investigation.
Pain is my art. That's what I cry for. Straight from my heart. Another word to die for. 'Cause you always try to bring it out of me. You always try to get the best of me. You always try to bring it out of me. Just to let me die. My hero is my friend. That's what I play with. Straight from my pen is how I wrote this. Yeah.
Brought to you firsthand by real investigators in the field. No hoaxes, no disinformation. You're listening to The Ghost Project.
I found myself face to face with someone or something that was attempting to play with my psyche as well as my physical being.
How sure are you of that?
I'm 100% sure of that.
Talk.
Very fast show tonight.
I know, we're like almost done.
This is the home stretch. You guys, the website is ufophysical.com. That's UFOPHYSICAL.com. We're talking to Ted Phillips about trace evidence of UFO encounters.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, and the vast majority of his over 3,000 cases.
We'll say that because
I'm going to generalize.
3,387, am I right?
That's it.
Yeah. Whoa! All right.
Photographic memory.
Yeah. Goldfish, you know,
got nothing on me.
Witnesses, as well as trace evidence.
Yeah, yeah.
It's absolutely amazing. So we were talking, of course, about the Roswell.
Yeah, we said the R word.
We did that. We had to do it. We're
laymans to this thing.
Yeah.
We're total laymans.
And
to
so
this.
We're learning about this, and I'm really glad we have you, Ted, to
shed some light on.
Yeah,
that.
To let us get it straight in our heads. The
that's great, guys. Thanks.
You said that there's current attempts. To reach, there's a project that was on a list of things to talk to, and I have to learn what it is because I didn't do my research. I've been a bad host.
Well, we didn't have a lot of time to prepare for this one either.
No, this was like Friday. We figured out that this was going to be ahead. Project Moonshaft.
Yeah.
Wow, yes. It just sounds so. Well, it's got a couple of connotations. So, tell us a brief history of Project Moonshaft and what's up with that.
Okay, that really is the primary project for our SIU Special Investigations Unit, and basically in 1970, I was contacted by a fellow researcher and. He said, "You got to talk to my neighbor." And this guy is an engineer from Czechoslovakia, and he's got quite a story. And after he gave me a few details, wife and I went out there about a week later and talked with him. And the guy's name was Antonian T. Hurok. And Tony and his wife fled Slovakia and the Czech Republic at the end of World War II, and this guy, very intelligent, he had four university degrees from Prague and a couple of universities in Slovakia in engineering and linguistics, and very impressive. And basically and quickly what happened was, and after the Nazis invaded Poland and then Czechoslovakia, they arrested all the business people, and they threw Tony into a concentration camp, and he was there from 1939 to 41, and he managed to escape, and he fled into Slovakia, and he joined the underground fighters there. And by 1944, he was fighting in the Tatra Mountains, which is on the border of Slovakia and Poland, and in the middle of a huge snowstorm, in October of 44, he and his battalion of 184 men was attacked by the Nazis, and they were all wiped out with the exception of Tony and two of his men, and they were left for dead. And a Slovakian farmer found them and treated their wounds, built a stretcher for Martin, who was most seriously injured, and took them up into the mountains, a four-hour climb, and hid them in a cave with a very small entrance. And inside the cave, it immediately opened up into a fairly large room, and they were to stay there out of sight of the Germans. And Tony was surprised by the fact that the Slovakian started going through the holy rites on himself, on them, and on the cave. And he took Tony aside and he said, "Please don't go deeper into the cavern, because it is haunted, and there are bottomless pits," and so on. And, of course, being an engineer and having worked as manager of mines and owning, as a matter of fact, a number of mines on his property in the Czech Republic.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as Slavik, the Slovakian, left, he packed up a little bit of gear and went on back into the cave. And the main reason was that they had not eaten for 4 days. And caves have bats, and you know, they're not chicken, but I guess they'll do. And so he went in hunting food, and he wound up going about 2 miles back into the cavern. It's a very large, complex thing. And he came to a long, level passage, and at the end of it was a crawlway, and as he crawled through this, he could see on the other side of the crawlway a large room, and at the end of it, a good size expanse of a black, silky material. He said it was like looking into a jet black mirror. And on this material, which stretched up about 24 feet high and about 16 feet wide, cave formations had formed on this material. And so that excited him somewhat, because the material did not appear to be anything normal mm-hmm. that he had seen before. And by the cave formations having formed on it, it had been there for not just a few hundred years, but thousands of years, and the formations formed around it. Well, on the front of this which turned out to be the outer wall of a large artifact, there was a crack, and at the base of the crack, where it reached the floor of this room, it was barely large enough, by taking his clothes off, that he could wriggle through it. And after several attempts, he did, and he rolled down an incline into the back wall of this thing.
Ooh.
And it turns out, of course, as he was going through the front wall, that this wall was 8 feet thick. And it was of a material that he'd not seen before. And when he fired up his carbide lamp, he was standing inside a crescent moon-shaped shaft, or the artifact, the inside of the artifact itself, with, as he said, mathematically curved walls, front and back, and extending up to a point that he couldn't see. It just ran out of light.
Mm-hmm.
And so he, each day, while they were hidden in the cave, he would go back to the artifact to explore it, and he even fired his military rifle at one of the walls, trying to chip off a piece that he could bring out and hopefully have analyzed later. And the military rifle didn't even scratch this stuff, whatever it was made of.
Uh-huh.
And it was totally smooth, no seams, rivets, any signs of any construction sections. And where it gets really interesting is, during his visits back there, he took his military pick and shovel and started excavating a limestone deposit that seemed to be a floor that he was standing on inside this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And he finally, over a period of time, dug down, broke down through about 6,000 years of limestone deposit and inside this thing. And beneath that, he found bones of a large animal. And he brought out three of the teeth, which I have currently.
Oh, okay.
And after the war, he had those teeth checked by the custodian of a large museum in the Ukraine. And he identified the teeth as being that of a prehistoric cave bear. And so this animal is underneath 6,000 years of deposit. And the animal itself would have to be on the order of 100,000 to a million years old. And it's inside this thing. And the animal was lying on what looked like a wavy grill that went on down below his feet, and he couldn't see through it, but he put his cheek against it and he could feel heat coming up.
Mm-hmm.
Which is very unusual for a cavern that deep. And he could hear far below him something running that he could only equate with a large turbine engine. And so finally, well, I shouldn't say it that way, one of his men died, and they were then able to bury him and plan on rejoining their army near Kosice in Slovakia. So as they prepared to leave the cave, he went back into it, and he was very concerned about sort of tomb robbers eventually finding out about this, finding the cave and finding the artifact, and defacing it or trying to blow it out of the mountain or whatever.
Yeah.
So as he left the artifact for the last time, he left his gold watch with his initials on it inside the artifact and some small powdery pieces that he managed to get off of the wall where he went through the crack.
Mm-hmm.
And as he came out, he totally covered three small passages. So without the map of the cave, if anyone found the cave, they could not possibly find the artifact.
Mm-hmm.
And fortunately, I have the map, and he let me copy all of his sketches of the artifact, outside, interior, the cave map, and the area around it, and so on, in 1970. And I told Alan Hynek about it immediately after I talked with Hurok. And Alan went and talked with him. And we were both so impressed that we started trying to get funding to get over there, to get at it, in 1970. And Jackie Gleason, who you may have seen on the Honeymooners. And
We're familiar with Jackie Gleason's interest in the UFO phenomenon.
Oh, yes.
Definitely.
Well,
yes.
Gleason agreed to fund my trip over there in 1970, and unfortunately, as we're trying to get over there and get everything set up, which back then was really difficult, the Russians had invaded Czechoslovakia 2 years before,
mm-hmm.
and we had four contacts that Tony had given us over there that would get supplies and stuff. And they were all arrested by the Russians and killed before I could go. And so the project was called off. So it was then, not until 1999, that I made my first trip over there. And I've been there twice, and I'm reasonably sure that I've found the cave. And if not, I now have, by retracing the history of this and talking to many people and so on, have the location of the cave within a very small area. So one of our primary, the SIU projects, is to get the funding to get back there and get to this thing. Because whatever it is, it's large. There was still activity of some kind going on in the bowels of this thing.
Yeah.
And it is many, many thousands of years old. So who was around to build this thing? And it actually appears from the geology involved that this thing pre-existed the cave, the forming of the cave, and perhaps even the forming of the mountain it's in. And so it could change a bit of history if we could get to it.
You know, that's an interesting take on that as far as it may even be pre-existing the cave system.
Exactly.
You know, me, with my mind, I'm thinking, well, maybe whatever they built, I mean, maybe, you obviously said the cave was growing off of this thing. I mean, that's how old it was.
Yes, right.
It seems that maybe whoever built it maybe put it that deep in the cave system because they didn't want it discovered. I mean, that may be an idea, too.
Mm-hmm. Of course, that could be a possibility, but 2 miles back into this thing, and it's 2,700 feet below the top of the mountain,
mm-hmm.
and would have been a really difficult project. And the thing that really intrigues me, and that's why I keep mentioning this 6,000 years of limestone deposit inside it, creating this kind of false floor, and knowing the forming times of these large cave formations on the outer wall of it, this thing is extremely old.
Mm.
And the interesting thing is that the Russians initiated an official project to find it in 1981. Unfortunately for them, Tony died in 1976,
mm-hmm.
and they don't have the sketches and the maps and so on. And they have contacted me, you know, saying, well, couldn't we work together? And I said, sure, here's where I would look. And, of course, I sent them to the most rugged area of the Tatras as possible. So let me put it this way. They ain't going to find the cave. So, but anyway, that's one of our projects. And it, believe me, on the site we have a lot, I have put a lot of information on that. And his diary is on there on the site. And it's the most fascinating reading that you can run across. He describes all of his problems and getting to it and getting in it and so on, and his feelings as to what it is based on 1944 technology.
Uh-huh.
And so it's really great. Another goal that I should mention of the SIU is the Marley Woods project.
Yeah, we have that here too.
And that is very exciting. I was contacted by one of the property owners in December of 1998 after he checked me out thoroughly because they want no publicity.
Mm-hmm.
And he and his wife had a terrific sighting, and he had been taking some video of this stuff. And so I've been investigating that since December of 98.
Mm-hmm.
And the primary purpose originally, and we created the SIU in January of 2007,
mm-hmm.
is to not just investigate cases or go in and try to pick up pieces after the fact, but to insert the team into an active area where we can get real-time imaging of what's going on
mm-hmm.
And record data in real time. And, you know, after all these years of going in after the fact, this was one of my really pet goals, is to be there when it's happening. And this is the only place in all these years that I've actually witnessed UFO activity that I couldn't explain. And so much has been going on there since we've been able to track cases, sightings back uh-huh. in that area, to as early as 1937, and right now I have on file 193 witnesses, none of which have ever gone public, and 539 observations in this relatively small area. And we've already been able to get video of some of the activity, and as the weather gets a little bit better, we'll be back there getting more images and doing more research, and we're posting that in as near real time as we can on the website. And so if anyone listening is really into this stuff, it's a great place to go to get the very current stuff. And we're also posting video on there, and we're coming out, this may be of interest to some,
mm-hmm.
in order to raise more research funds, we're coming out with a DVD of our work, and a lot of that is on the Marley Woods project, the 1st of April.
Oh,
and
that's right up my alley.
Yeah, you just struck a chord with Doug. I know you did, Ted.
That is right up my alley, Ted. I love it when people can put together stuff into such a format. I mean, because obviously you're not going to like Paramount and saying, you know, I got to start where
right.
you put this together. You're taking actual real stuff, and you're probably
yes.
filming yourself trying to explain this stuff, and you're doing it the hard way,
mm-hmm.
you know,
yes.
and putting together a thing to put on a DVD and that people can pop in at any time and just and sit back, relax, and enjoy. Essentially what the fruit of your labors is, you know, that you,
yes.
they get a complete rundown, a complete history, you get
yeah.
all this info in just the space and time of a DVD, which is, it's right up my alley because it's not, you know, being produced by Hollywood. It's real
yeah,
stuff.
Exactly.
Real stuff.
Exactly, yeah. I've done quite a number of the History Channel things, and you know, they're good, and it's brought a lot of attention to some of the work. But this way we can kind of get out and people can see actual video taken by real people, not just us, but witnesses there in Marley Woods.
Mm-hmm.
And the videos in the DVD were taken in the presence of sometimes 20 people. And these are, you know, friends and neighbors and so on that come to the farm to see this stuff.
Yeah.
And it's a terrific variety of things going on. And one of the most intriguing things are the small light balls, which range in size from baseball to a basketball size,
mm-hmm.
and actually have gone between, in one case, two people who were standing 10 feet apart, shoulder high, between them. So that's pretty close observation.
Yeah.
And there are unseen forces at action over there, electromagnetic effects cases, landing sites. We've had everything over there except the little guys. And
wow.
They're probably lurking somewhere, you know.
Oh, man.
But anyway, it's fascinating stuff, and it's going on right now. The latest sighting was last Wednesday, so.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah, you mentioned that the 13th of February was the latest sighting you guys had.
Right, right.
Man. You know what? And this is another one of those times, Doug,
when the end of the show rears.
I could sit here and listen to you talk all night, Ted.
I could too.
Seriously,
I really could.
We find this stuff so fascinating. You know, this is a classic case of synchronicity right here. I have to say, we were talking about synchronicity earlier with another guest, Kyriakos, Ted, and
uh-huh.
I'm a synchronicity nut. We can talk about that later if you want, but you know, the show, as you know, you came on last minute to do the show with us here. Our buddy Tim Yancey came on last minute to do the show with us here. And you know, if these events hadn't been put in place, we never would have been in contact with you, Ted, you see?
Exactly.
And it just,
exactly.
I'm happy it worked out the way it did.
Oh, I am too.
I am absolutely.
Ted.
Well, it's been fun, guys, and believe me, there's always way more to talk about than there is time.
I believe that, especially with your video coming up.
We
got
to talk to you some more about
that. Before, you said April. Now,
April
I don't know
1st.
If April 1st might be the best release day because...
Well, I hadn't thought about
you
that.
You might want to make it April 2nd.
You know what? Here's the irony. I'm going to let the cat out of the bag on this one. Here's the irony, Ted. We're talking to Stanton Freeman on that day, aren't we? I think we're talking. It's Easter Sunday, isn't it?
Yeah. No.
Really?
No, because Easter Sunday is the weekend before that.
Okay. I know we're talking to Stanton Freeman right around that time.
Well,
he and I are both giving presentations at the Aztec New Mexico Conference the last weekend in March.
Oh, wow.
So that would be right in that period, and I'll be spending a good deal of time with Stanton down there.
Well, you tell him that if you talk to him before that, you tell him that the guys from Ghostly Talk say hello, and we're looking forward to talking to him.
Oh, definitely.
Okay.
And you know what? When he's on, we'll definitely have to
mention you.
And,
we're going to have to I think we're going to have to put together another Ultimate Jam session. We'll get all you guys on the phone.
Oh, that would be
awesome. It'll be fun.
Yeah.
But we do have to close
the show. Hang on for one second, Ted. Don't leave us just yet.
Hold on the line.
Okay,
but I do want to thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks, Ted.
Your website, of course, is ufophysical.com. That's ufophysical.com.
Yeah.
Don't forget the DVD's coming up in
April 1st.
A month and a half or so.
Yeah,
so bookmark that site and go there in April and scoop up a copy. I'd like to thank Tim Yancey for coming on the show earlier.
Good buddy. Yep.
TimYancey.com or...
EncountersLive.com. I always forget that.
And of course, Kyriakos, who just totally
blew me away.
Absolutely phenomenal stuff. It's www.kyriakos.biz. KYRIAKOS.biz.
Mm-hmm. We're gone next weekend.
We are not doing a show next weekend. Yeah. We're going to be at
the
film festival.
Yeah, Decatur,
so
Illinois.
PrairieGhosts.com.
/winter.html.
That's the event we'll be at. We want to see you guys there. I want to thank everybody for listening.
Thank you so very much.
And we'll be back in a couple weeks with more. Our website, www.ghostlytalk.com.
Ghostly Talk!
You have been listening to Ghostly Talk Paranormal Talk Radio. The Ghostly Talk audio program is distributed for free under the Open Content License. Please share with all your friends and support independent media.